This is Joan Weaver and Rosetta Graff of the Kinsey Library. It's March 3rd, 2011, and we are at the library interviewing Dennis Kinsfather. Did I say that right?
Yes.
And you want to tell us your full name?
Dennis Stinson Kinsfather.
And where do you currently reside?
In Kinsley, Kansas.
And when and where were you born?
In Kinsley, Kansas in 1939, November 25th.
And what were the names of your parents?
Andrew Kinsfather, he had the middle name, and Darlene Kinsfather. Velda was her middle name, but she didn't like people to know that.
And what was her maiden name?
Stinson.
Okay. And then your grandparents, what were their names?
Oscar Stinson and Bertie Stinson. They lived in Kinsley, and Henry Kinsfather and Sophie Kinsfather, they too lived in Kinsley, but Henry passed away when I was, in 1944, when I was either 4 or 5 years old, depending on when my birthday occurred. I don't remember the date he was passed away, but I have one memory of him. And then Bertie.
And what is that memory? You're just
that memory is of butchering a hog in Kinsley where they lived. It was hung up in the doorway to the garage adjacent to the home. And my mother did not want me to see that. But I prevailed upon my grandfather. It was quite a contest between he and my mother. But he prevailed and...
So did you see the hog killed and then
no,
butchered or just butchered?
That part I was not allowed to see, but I remember very much wanting to see the butchering of it because they made not only all the meat parts from the hog, but also soap that came from the cooking of the fat, and I learned about that process, and I was extremely interested in it. I remember to this day the hanging hog in the doorway to their garage. That's the only memory I have of my grandfather, Kinsfather, but they spoke German all the time in the home. And I was, apparently, according to Mom, using a lot of German words because I was there so much. He would come and get me each morning in the car and I guess almost have a whiplash when he'd take off with letting his clutch out too fast in his car. But he gathered me up almost every morning, and I was there most of the day until Mom became tired of it. And he wanted, as a matter of fact, for me to move in over there. He and I were buddies, but I am told.
Now, because I'm just thinking of the German name, did he make sausage and things like that, or was it just
Oh, my
general?
Goodness. Grandmother was, her famous dish was dumplings, and I would absolutely die for a recipe of the dumplings made by grandmother. And living with them were three of their children, Dad's brothers and sisters, Daniel, Louise, and Esther. And Louise and Esther worked in the hospital. Louise in the kitchen, and Esther, I'm not sure, nurse and cook aide, but I think a nurse's aide. What she did, but I was there so much while growing up that, and they had a 100-acre farm out north of town, which I currently own, that they initially settled at when they moved here from Pawnee Rock, where they came first.
Do you know about
settle.
What year that was that they came here?
Well, I know they went through the what's the name of the island in New York?
Ellis
Island, either in 1900 or 1901. And they were the last that were able to get out of Russia because they came from Russia. Their parents had immigrated to Russia from Germany because Catherine the Great was interested in the Germans taking over the farming in the Volga region of Russia. And then there became such a distrust of the later of the Germans by the Russians that they were sent, most of them, to Siberia. And the escape from Russia to Germany was such that they were among the last to make it back to Germany and then to America in either 1900 or 1901. They came to Pony Rock with some of his brothers, Grandpa's brothers. One, George, went wound up down in Coldwater, and I'm not sure of the names of the other brothers, but there were, I think, three brothers that came over, and they settled up near Roselle or Ransom or someplace around in there. But, and Dighton. But,
and what got him here to Kinsley?
Water. That's a question I asked of Daniel. Daniel is a bit of a historian, and he was the last to die of the 13 children that Grandma and Grandpa Kinsfather had. Dad was the youngest. Dad, my father, Andrew, was the youngest. And my grandfather settled first in Pony Rock, and then because of what he regarded as a highly valuable resource, water, being so close to the surface here, they moved from there to Kinsley and wound up buying that 100 acres north of town. They did live southwest of town, over more south of Offaly, for a while in a huge home, probably between, I would say, roughly 8 to 10 miles southwest of Kinsley. I've been to the place, and it was a rented facility, but a monstrous home. And there's pictures of that from Mike. I can get you some pictures of that. From my cousin in Fresno, California, who was Manuel's son, Dad's brother. But anyhow, water was a resource that Grandpa highly desired, and so they came to Kinsley and settled here, and we were able to drill a water well by hand. Just easily do so. Everybody did it. That's how we watered our lawns. You just put a sand point on the end of, you hand drill with it. Turning hand drill.
It was only down a few feet.
Yeah, only 6, 7, 8 feet. And if you went down 10 or 12 feet, you couldn't pump it dry. So we cleaned our trailers or trucks with well water. Earl Stinson, my uncle, had that. I mean, everybody in town that had any needs beyond just a little in the way of water had their own well, because it was simple. You could do it all in a day yourself. And that was what appealed to my grandfather coming from Kinsley, so I'm told by Daniel.
Were there other German traditions that they brought with them? Do you remember any other?
Well, the ones
like a Christmas or?
Well, I know one thing, that because of World War II, they were disinterested in speaking German outside the home because of the shame brought upon them by Hitler and his destruction to the world.
Did they ever talk about the people having any backlash during the war?
Well,
towards them they were German?
They did not exactly roam around freely. They pretty well tight-knit groups, the Germans were, because they were ashamed of what Hitler and Germany had done in both wars, but particularly the second. And so one of the reasons I didn't learn German well is once grandfather died when I was 4 and a half years old, I wasn't at the home as much, and only I could be there. Anybody else that would be there, the English began to be spoken, because it was not something they were proud of. And that's unfortunate for me, having been denied the privilege of learning a language when you can learn it so easily. But I do have that warm feeling of, things that remind you of things you and times you loved
mm-hmm.
when I'm around German-speaking people, because the cooking of the Germans and the loving nature of the Germans and how much I was attracted to that made mm-hmm. me feel good. And I respond positively to that. But
and what brought your mother's people here, into this area?
Grandpa Stinson came here from Iowa, where he was engaged in farming, and he used a horse to haul coal, teams of horses to haul coal, and that's what he did here too. Why here rather than Iowa, I'm not sure.
By hauling coal, do you mean to delivering it to homes or to...
Yes, mm-hmm. yes. And then it began to be longer distances, but from and to, I don't know.
We can get it from the railroad.
Probably.
And Stinson, is that Scandinavian or English or... English, as far as I know.
And then he started hauling cars with the first trucks that there were from auto factories. I don't know where they were from, but I have a picture of one of his car haulers that I'll bring you. And
what year would that be when he started
hauling cars?
Mm-hmm.
I would guess in the 20s.
Would
be my guess. Mother was born in 1919. Dad was born in 1918, and he was in the trucking. He started the trucking business. Oscar Stinson did, my grandfather. They call him OC. His name was Oscar Commodore, but he didn't like the name Commodore, so he was known as OC. But that's how the trucking business began. And when my father got out of the Army in World War II. And I need to tell you about his arrival, and I'm jumping a little bit. So you want to ask questions, or
we're doing fine. But we maybe need to talk about your dad if he was in World War II.
I remember my father when he went to the war, because there were two children when he was finally called to be in the Army, drafted. And so he wasn't among the first. But being born in 1918, he was, 1943, he would have been like perfect, 25 years old for being drafted. And I recall the night he left, we lived, you remember where Jory's mm-hmm. restaurant was? Along the highway, and that house they just tore down about 3 years ago, just immediately east. That's where we lived. It was an old junk pile then. I remember, in want of repair, in need of repair, and the folks were totally broke. And it was a rented home, but I remember Mother crying the night he left, and he got down on his knees when he left and handed me a dollar bill and told me to take care of Mom and the kids. And that would have been when I was like four, about the time Grandpa died. And then they moved after he left over to a place. Do you remember the Molitors, where they lived over? From that Quonset on the highway, my father built that. That was the second trucking business place. From that Quonset on the west side, north of there, about a house or two, is where we were moved to after Dad left for the war, because it was near my grandfather Stinson. And my mother wanted to be near them
mm-hmm.
when Dad was gone, because it was walking easy, like two blocks from Grandpa and Grandma Stinson.
And there were three children at this time, you said? You and...
Tom, my youngest brother, me and my sister Pat, she was second, and then Tom, and he was born in 1944-45, right about the time the war ended.
When your father left, then she probably was pregnant then, or
either that or became pregnant very soon thereafter.
Or
when
after.
We went down to on a bus to some base where they were being trained at the time to go to war. But there was only one interlude during that whole time where we lived place someplace other than Kinsley, and that was for about 6 months in Bremerton, Washington, where one of the stints of Mom's sister lived, and my mother tried to go there. And I don't know why we came back, but we did.
Where did your dad serve in?
In Germany.
In Germany?
Yes, and he was in the Battle of the Bulge, and excuse me, and he was served until the war ended, and he would tell a few stories about the war, but he was very reluctant to talk about it. It was hard to jar loose any memories of it, but the way I was able to succeed in doing that before he died was to get some CDs of Hitler's speeches and all the hoopla that preceded the speeches, where he'd get the whole crowd psyched up and almost crazy, so that when he said his first word, they were fainting and falling, and all the signs and paraphernalia and the bands and, you know, the badges everybody wore. Hitler was a wonderful speaker in the sense that he knew how to get the crowd on his side. He did accomplish most of that before he ever started talking, because he was late for all his speeches. The crowd was sweating and worked up, and where, you know, he was bringing Russia out of, or Germany out of the depression through the investment that they made in all the war materials. So it was good for Germany to economically to have this marauding of Europe going on at, you know, at their expense, but not Germany. Germany was benefiting. Anyhow, I'm straying away a little bit,
now you remember him leaving? Do you remember him coming back?
I remember him leaving, and I very vividly recall him coming back. He came in on the train with a bunch of other soldiers, and we lived in that home north of that Quonset building, and I remember there were so many people in the home, and I remember here come this man in, and I hadn't seen him for a long time. Very red face and very big. Dad was 6'2", and I thought a giant of a man. Mm-hmm. But of course, everybody was happy to see him. A lot of crying and all that. Mm-hmm. But he then started working in the trucking business for my grandfather as a driver, and then wanted to get his own trucking business. And my grandfather helped him get his own permit, because in those days, it was very difficult to you had to go to Topeka and get an attorney to represent you and demonstrate through the customers that you took with you their need for transportation that was unfulfilled. And it was quite an ordeal to have the rights for trucking, and they were county by county origins and county by county or statewide destinations. Very, very restrict and very valuable. And now that we have deregulations, and have had for 20 years or so, you know, that's all passed. But it was quite an ordeal. I bet you I was in Topeka 20 times when my grandfather and my father were asking for extensions of operating authority. In fact, my grandpa Stinson couldn't read or write. And he was very successful. And would take me couple times with him to read the maps that they would present him in Topeka, saying, "Oscar, what counties do you have?" Well, I didn't bring my glasses, and he'd fumble around. It was a shame to say he couldn't read or write. They all knew it, but he wouldn't admit to it. And he signed his name with an X. But he was very good. He had a fabulous memory and very bright. He could figure better close to, you could figure out what a load of corn or wheat, he'd buy and sell wheat and corn off the hip. He didn't ever use a pencil because he didn't do any good.
So at this time, the trucking is now into...
Dad is getting operating authority.
That was for agricultural?
Gasoline. All petroleum products. The first permit was to haul petroleum products from a McPherson and El Dorado, where the co-op refiners were, to Dodge City, Kansas, Ford County.
To like and the then, gas stations and is that?
No, it was to the tanks. At that time, the overhead tanks that were used to haul fuel from to farmers and wherever. And he did that, and our tanks would hold, I think, like 3,000 or 4,000 gallons. And there were little six-cylinder engines, five-speed transmissions. And the hill between here and Dodge City that you no one would know about now, I know very well because in riding with the truck, Dad in the truck, as I did thousands of times, he would have to downshift to make that hill because just immediately west of Spearville is a rise in the road. No driver would ever know that today, but the trucks just consume more fuel and go same speed. But you sure did in those days because those little engines were barely able to make it. But I learned to drive early because, you know, like all kids with a dad with a truck line would couldn't wait to be in it. And I was hauling gasoline and grain and cattle when I was junior high. No license.
No license.
Stopped all the time. Oh, you're who are you? You're no logbook, no license. My father owns this. Oh, that was my pass. It's hard to believe you could do that, but I went through so many scales hauling grain.
So this would have been about
1952, thereabouts, three. You know, I'm 14 years old. I was driving trucks to Kansas City and all around. And of course,
loaded
for
with
me,
fuel.
Well, cattle and grain then, but
that
was made me wait until I was around 15 to haul fuel. But I would, at that time, I could go and then unload the trucks because he had three tankers at the height of his fuel hauling days. And the men would be tired. Cliff Riddle was one driver and Ralph Franklin was another. They only had two. And they'd bring, and Dad would bring the loads from McPherson or El Dorado to Kinsley. And I would, our biggest haul was to Dodge City, but we hauled to Dodge City, Buckland, Ford, Kingsdown, Jetmore, and then Grandpa Stinson hauled to Ransom and count places north. But anyhow, I was good at unloading the fuel because my dad had taught me how. So I could back up a dad just to have drivers come to work for him. And when I was in high school, he'd be bragging, engaging their brand of braggadocio, you know, how good a driver they were. And he said, well, I bet that kid can outback you. I never, ever failed him. Because he knew exactly what kind of test to give me. Of course, you know, a kid, why wouldn't I be good? Did it 10,000 times. But the truck line then grew from hauling only gas to gas and grain and then grain and cattle. And we also hauled Mayrath augers made in Dodge City, Kansas, to grain augers that were invented by Mayrath. In open-top cattle trailers to Canada. That was a big deal for Dad, a great haul. He would never let me go because I was head slave around the truck line. I got to grease all the trucks and change the tires and all that, and he wouldn't let me be gone long.
Now, did he pay you, or?
No.
No.
No, that was not, never, never. I didn't even expect it because I was privileged to be able to engage in athletics because when I got out of high school class, in order to be allowed to play football, basketball, and track, which I did, I had to go after that and look at the blackboard at the truck line, which is just, you know, one block from the high school, and see what jobs there were for me to do that night. This is change the oil on 23 and right inside tires flat and so-and-so and, you know, those projects. But that's what everybody worked. It wasn't just me. All my classmates were mostly farmers. They were running tractors at night. I mean, it was just what you did. There was nothing You didn't feel special. But I had to do that work. And I was...
So you went to your athletic practice and then...
Yeah, and then went... That was it. And sometimes I couldn't wait and I'd run home and grab a sandwich or something and then come back and I'd have to kind of sneak to do that because Dad would be very anxious about getting that work done. Because he couldn't hire somebody mm-hmm. to do that. He was broke.
Okay. It wasn't a labor shortage. It was
more of an economic issue. It was, yeah. I didn't get my second coat for the winter until I was a junior in high school. Because, you know, prior to that, I had one coat for the winter.
Was he putting money back into the trucking?
And church and work.
Was he putting the money back into the trucking that he was making and building up the business?
Yes. But it was, you know, everybody was poor. We didn't know anybody except Ed Leopold around here that had money. Ed Leopold had a Cadillac and hauled oil in the front seat of his car and hay in the trunk. And we hauled cattle for him. He's the only man around that I recall had money. Well, I guess that's not true. The Judy Elmore's grandfather, who had Dillon's. What was his name?
Sweetland.
Yeah, Sweetland. He was welcome. And I guess the banker was. What was his name? That had the bank. He's the one that Dad convinced to help him with his first truck. I guess that was a very momentous day. I remember it. Dad came home crying with happiness that he was able to talk him into a loan.
Do you know what trucks cost back then?
No. I don't, but I know what I remember hearing about what a new Buick cost in those days, and it was like either $3,900 or $4,900. Mm-hmm. And I drove a Model T to school when I was a junior, one that a lady owned in West Kinsley, and had to crank it to start it. And I was quite pleased with that. I mean, that beat the bicycle. But one of the nice things is unusual. You wouldn't expect the little narrow tires of a Model T to do well for you in mud, but for some reason, that tiny tire, you could not hardly get one stuck. They're down the muddiest road of the area, and you could not get one stuck. You know how you think the flotation tire is the only solution? Not true, because the ground 5, 6, 7 inches down is hard, and those narrow tires would go to the hard part of the road. So I never ever got stuck with that car.
And you were in all the sports in high school and
yeah,
good
and I
teams?
Was
a, or?
I was big in basketball. I was not bragging, but that was my game. Mm-hmm. In fact, Coach Carpenter was so angry with me when I graduated because I wouldn't go to a junior college. Mm-hmm. My mother thought I was unusually smart, like all mothers do. You know, little Johnny is the smartest kid in town. They still do it today. and you know, it's an emotional thing, but my mother thought I was, and so I would move forward a year. I was 16 when I...
Oh, when you graduated?
Yeah.
And with a... you see, your grandfather, you said, couldn't read or write, right?
I guess I was 16 when I went into my senior year, and I turned 17 in December, in late November. Yeah, I'm sorry. What?
Well, your grandfather couldn't read or write.
No.
But somewhere your education was important.
Oh, my mother preached to me that daily. I mean, and Clyde Lavellette was the great basketball star of the day, and I, being an interest in basketball, worship going to KU, mm-hmm. and it was an insane affinity because I hurt myself because Carpenter told me, he says, you're still growing, you're still maturing. For instance, at the beginning of my senior year, I could not dunk a basketball, and I was 6'3", but I could jump like two rabbits, and it was my game. I was good at it, but beginning of the basketball year in October, I couldn't dunk a ball. But at the end of the year, I could. And I was just really going. And there were scouts that would come from all colleges and stuff, but I never was. I got, and Dad was very angry at me about this, but I had full ride scholarships to all the schools except K-State and KU. No, I wouldn't take it. And Dad needed, it's hard for me to tell you how difficult it was come college time, because he was so angry with me. He would, Dad's way of punishing you was to ignore you. Unless he was just terribly angry.
So then when you went to KU, did you have to pay the bill yourself?
He did it, but he was very angry. Because I could have, he could have gotten it. And Carpenter, who we enlisted, Dad enlisted his support because he was the coach, he said, "You are the best back," because he'd come from two or three other things, "You're the best basketball player I've ever coached. You're just too damn young. And if you would just give yourself a year or two, I guarantee you could play at KU." So I tried to walk on as a player, did it my way, which was wrong. But Will Chamberlain was 1 year ahead of me. A great, great basketball man. And I survived the first cut, and I was praying to survive the second, but I didn't. And they cut me. But it's understandable. I was a big fish in a little pond. And, you know, how your perspective in Kinsley, Kansas, as a kid that doesn't travel anywhere except where you're all cattle to, is so myopic. You have no idea how the big world works. I wish I had some peers from bigger communities, or at least some travel, so I could have had a bigger world view of things and been able to look at myself better, because I really harmed myself in something that I loved.
Did you get to play a little bit with Wilt? Or,
only for 3 weeks until they got me.
Well, but that's something.
Then I became
more
a spectator just like everybody else. Yeah.
And I don't know, did they have intramurals then or anything? Were you able to play?
I was so distraught by that. I couldn't hardly look at a basketball court for a while. Because I worshipped the whole ground the game sat upon. And, you know, I was just too devoutly interested to be of much use in anything else. It's called immaturity.
And what year did you graduate?
From high school? 57.
57. So we're talking that. And did Kinsley do well in basketball that year? Were you able
to? Yes, we beat the heck out of Pratt. I remember that. I stuffed it right down their throat, me and my friends, my buddies. But for the second or third game of my life, I fouled out in the last game of Haven beat us in the third tournament, I think it was. And we were just simply better than we were. Simple as that.
Okay.
But we did very well.
That's really interesting. Let's see. So now you're at KU. We've got you there. And you're going to major in?
I went first for pre-med, but when I saw my first cadaver, I changed my mind. I couldn't take that. Then went to engineering and then business.
Maybe before we go on, because I wanted you to talk about the Arkansas River and fishing and
growing
and
up,
what
it was
like.
Flowing well, and it was abundant with fish. And
what types?
Catfish and carp were predominant, and carp, you know, I didn't know it until I left for college, but it was something that we all ate. And you take that black stripe off away down the side, and it was good eating from a pressure cooker when loaded with bones, but that was not an issue once they were pressure cooked. You'd eat the bones too. And so we loved and ate carp. and I speared them in the river. I made spears at the shop truck line to do myself because they were so big you could see their backs and because they're top feeders, they go around the edge, and I got all the carp we ever needed. And hunting too, which I dearly love to do, I didn't pay any attention to hunting regulations, and neither did anybody else. I never saw a game warden until after college in my life. And we loved
what were you
pheasants,
hunting? Pheasant?
Pheasants, quail,
rabbit.
They're not that good eating.
How about the deer population?
Oh, the rabbits were being sought after. They were good for, they paid for rabbits. There was a bounty on them. If you hauled them to Dodge City, you could sell them.
Was that just to get rid of them because there were
so
many?
No, they were good for a pelt.
Mm-hmm.
They were used for a pelt. And there was some kind of a mink farm, mm-hmm. I think, in Dodge, I believe it was. But anyhow, there was some use for fur, but mostly for men. I never did see that thing.
And was the deer population at this time?
You rarely saw a deer. If you saw a deer, you told people about it. Kind of like we would a lion these days. Yeah, that's all new, the population over there.
Okay, now we'll go back to KU, because I wanted to remember to talk about the river. So you went from pre-med, and then you told us a story the other day about how you switched and got interested in
from going to KU to Indiana. Mm-hmm. It was at the inauguration of Summerfield Hall, which was the business school built, and it would have been in fall of 59, and that was when it was inaugurated. And instead of watching a boring football game, I chose on TV my little black and white that was about like this. I went to that inauguration, and this fellow there by the name of L.L. Waters, whose book you have, Steel Trails to Santa Fe, here, was speaking, and he was a visiting professor from Indiana University, and I didn't know it then, but he had come from Ransom or someplace up here. North of us, and when I went to talk to him after the speech, because it was so impressive, and he was head of the Department of Transportation in Indiana, was visiting here for a year, for a semester, I forget, but I was so impressed with him that he took to me and checked out my grades and all that, and then he called me up one day and asked me to come in and want to talk to me. And there he said, look, I'd like you to come to Indiana University. And I was totally taken aback. I mean, that'd be like a trip overseas. And then, the money issue was the thing there. And,
did they have the out-of-state tuition then at that time?
Yes, but I think our tuition in the fall of 57 when we were there was $103 or $7. That's what it was at that time. Well, I remember Dad's built a filling station where Romano's is.
Mm-hmm.
My father built that building. He was going to get rich in them because he hauled fuel, so he thought, well, I'll sell it too. And we sold diesel fuel because I run that station, for a couple hours a day when school was out and so on sometimes. It was Gordon Burnett that worked for Dad, who just died here a while back. But he was the bulk fuel hauler. But 4.9 cents a gallon for diesel fuel. It's a true story. 4.9 cents. Now, I don't recall what regular was like that. There would be a pure guess. I don't know.
And I got to go back to something too in a minute. But when you went to KU, did you drive your car? Is that how you went back and forth to college, or carpool?
Yeah,
or?
I had a deal with. Made a deal with my father when I was a senior. He wanted me to break the 30-point level at school, at a game. And it was at a game in somewhere west of here, I think somewhere. And I wasn't doing well in the first part of the game. I was stone cold. He hollered at me from the side because Dad was not bothered by him. Come over. And he and Carpenter were good friends, so Dad evidently thought I could get away with it. With anyhow, you make 30 points this game and I'll buy that damn Ford you've been looking at down there. And it was an old used Ford car. That was when I was a senior. And I think he knew he was going to have to get me something to get to him from school, so this was his excuse. Well, I made 31 points. Man, you can't better believe it. I told my buddies at halftime, pass me the Baltimore. I got to deal with my dad and everybody help. And McQueen, where I have to tell you what we did was that McQueen out here that raised watermelons near the, remember him?
Yes, I know.
He raised, and I know he and Dad were buddies, but one of my lessons in life was, it was a tradition we all stole watermelons. Mm-hmm. And we'd eat them out here at the park, the base of the overpass, in front of the cops and everything. Well, we hauled a whole load of watermelons up the overpass and down there, and McQueen would shoot up in the air and you'd hear all these pellets dropping around. It was a game. I he loved it, you know. He'd plant watermelons for us thieves out there. But the thing that we all had to do, though, was Dad would maybe go out and work for him a couple of days. And that was, so it became a game. Hell, there were more buddies out there working with me than were at school sometimes. But and I know it would have to be a partnership among fathers, you know. You take, get these birds. You want any help, call him. He's going out. And so that was my punishment. The Dad would come out there and take my keys to the car and, you know, whatever else he could raise. I need to grab a water bottle on the way out. But we have to work out on McQueen's to work off our bad deed. Thank you.
Well, as long as we've gone back in time a little bit, I assume you were in civilization, so you always had electricity and water and everything in your home?
Yes. My uncle John Kinsfarter, north of town, though, had a two-hauler out there and a hand pump for water and a windmill or a wind generator of some kind with a whole bunch of batteries in the building. So we had bulb hanging in each room, and that's how we got light at night out there.
And when did you get TV?
When I was, I remember this very well, because it was black and white, where the signal came from Hutchison, and it was more snow than anything else, and it would have been when we first moved, so I would have been either the 6th or the 7th grade. So it would have been, so you go back 6 years from grade, 51, give or take a year. First
That's
TV.
That's pretty early.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was, I don't know why anybody ever bothered, because the Ed Sullivan show is about the only thing you ever see. It was so snowy that the issue was the strength of the signal.
Okay.
I remember FM stations. I'd never heard one until I went to college.
Oh, yeah.
We didn't have FM stations out there.
We haven't talked to anybody about radio stations ever. I wonder how we missed that. There never was one here in Kinsley, was there?
No.
A radio station?
Oh, no. Never, as far as I know.
Well, I grew up in Michigan for a little while. My little town had a radio station. But you could probably pick
Saturday
up
Saturday night was a very, very big deal here when I was in high school.
Tell us about that.
Everybody looked forward. This is junior high and high school. You're a big night. You can hardly wait for, well, two things. The Old Settlers Picnic in the summer. And Saturday night, because all the farmers come to town and everybody else did too. And park on both sides. It was a two-way street then, both sides of Main Street. In fact, I got my first ticket in my life coming back from college, going down the wrong side of Main Street. I didn't know that it was changed. So it was 57 that summer or fall of 57. The fall of 57 is when the Main Street became one way, not two way, because I got a ticket doing that. I didn't know it. I thought it was as it always was when I was growing up. And the cop, McBride, he didn't care. He was mad at me. He said I should have known. He said, not ignorance is no excuse. You go to college, you don't know better.
And so for the teenage entertainment besides sports, and all of you had jobs,
whatever. Fishing. Huh? We'd go fishing. It was fishing. A great deal. You go down to the river. Nettleton was a prime fishing hole. Mm-hmm. And you'd go down there and set bank lines, and why, you could bring home enough fish for mom's deep freeze for, and we had an international deep freeze, chest deep freeze, which I thought was fantastic. And that's where all the wild game went.
And the Nettleton Bridge, did you like the Nettleton Bridge?
Oh, yes.
Wasn't that cool?
It was. I mean, that was kind of the epicenter of summer activity in fall and spring, in my opinion.
The boys and girls?
Yes. I mean, there was a hot spot when I was in school.
Oh, in more ways than one.
Yeah. You took the girlfriends out there, and everybody did. I mean, there were hundreds of people down there, lots of weekends. I can't speak for the weekdays because it was working, but you work like a Dickens so you could go fishing. And all that wasn't too hard because Dad liked me to go because I'd run the bank lines at night and set the poles. He'd say, go out and set it, make them so you get limbs cut just right and cut the string and set it and catch frogs. Wait for a rainy day and get frogs for
that
bait.
Was your bait?
Yeah. The best. Worms if you didn't have that. But it was easy to dig worms. Just go to an old farm and manure bed and they're all around there. And dig worms and use frogs. I never did like grasshoppers with the Johnny Dog. But
and you would have like bonfires and...
Oh, absolutely. And even in the wintertime, we'd camp out there. All the time, yeah.
Tents
well,
or...
We'd go camping. Instead of having one fire, you'd have two. And the reason for that was, you know, why all sit around and have their backsides freeze? You know, well, it didn't take too much ingenuity to do two or three fires, and everybody sit in the center.
In the center.
Be warmed all the way around.
I never figured that out.
Well, you do if you go camping at zero or 10. You warm up to ideals like that.
Was the river frozen then, so it was more like ice?
No, it ran all the time. There'd be some around some of the holes where there wasn't much movement, but there was enough water in the river. You could not ice skate in the river. Mm-hmm. Everybody that tried it fell in. The floods were a deal. I remember looking from the theater, the Palace Theater, south, and the year I don't recall, but you could see water coming up the road, and I'm thinking it was south of 50, 56, to probably now where the swimming pool is, or somewhere right in there. It came that far up from the river. But
that would be from the Coon Creek?
No,
from the river. Okay.
But the Coon Creek and the drainage through the north part of Kansas always was a problem because my grandfather's land that I now own, you couldn't get to it unless you waded through deep water to get there because that, what is the road one block? Is it not Winchester, but the north-south road immediately west of Northside School. One block west.
That's Massachusetts.
That's the eastern border of my land. So that Massachusetts road, you know the cemetery road that runs east and west, the oil road? Well, when you from that point north, from like 50 yards north, is flooded. Every time we get big water around here, in fact, more than the river now, because of the work that was done on it. But you didn't think much of it. This is the way it worked when it rained too much.
Can you just answer me a silly question? Why do they call it an oil road when it's paved?
Because it's made out of petroleum products.
Oh. Because I always thought that you know, they used to treat dirt roads with I guess I think that was a petroleum product. They did just put
keep
the dust out.
Yeah, they spray heavy oil.
Yeah, but that's what I always thought an oil road was. But here it's actually a paved road.
Well, they make it right out west of town still today. Mm-hmm. They have a row of sand. They put in sand first, and then they spray it with oil, heavy oil, and use road grader to turn it over and spray it again. And then it becomes a product that will congeal and compress and with their big rollers make the nice road that you drive on.
Yeah.
That's what we always called it.
Yeah. I just wondered because it makes sense my limited background.
Anyhow, Saturday nights, I have to finish one thing. It was a hot night. I mean, everybody loves Saturday night. It was the nicest part of Western Kansas, in my opinion, because you knew everybody. Everybody knew you, and that idea of anonymity being a virtue was nothing that never occurred to anybody. And who would be in an environment like that? And I recall going to New Jersey and living there, and I could not stand everybody being a stranger. I hated the interaction, you know, that we were missing. We missed it deeply. I loved this town. You have 3,000 friends instead of 30. So that's why little towns are so good.
And you went to the theater, I assume, Palace, to see movies.
Oh, indeed. Saturday matinees were watch Hopalong Cassidy and Roy Rogers do their thing with Gene Autry.
And as a teenager, were there drive-ins or anything? Or?
Well, the only one was in Dodge.
No.
You didn't do that because that's too much money to buy. Gasoline.
There was skating, roller skating.
That was an issue. Gas, too, probably a quarter. Gallon what?
Roller skating.
Well, the Feldman's built a roller rink out here, which is what that dumpy building is just past the overpass. Marvin and Wilmer and Chet Feldman built that. I remember helping nail woods until they didn't like my nailing. I couldn't hit the nails well enough. But
about what year was that? Did they build it?
I'll guess 1953. But the reason I know it is my cousins, Wilmer Feldman was my uncle. He married Mother's sister, Mabel Stinson. And so Gene Feldman and Colleen Feldman were my cousins. And when they built that skating rink, of course, I was invited to come drive nails.
And at that time, was the trucking business out there, too?
Well, yeah, the so first place for our trucking business. You know, if you go to the high school, the east-west road on the south side of the high school, and take it to the railroad tracks west, you know that little bitty filling station there that has nothing in it? Had two big old round pumps with the glass, and Dad parked his first truck and then his second truck there. He rented it from whoever. I don't know who owned it. And then he built that Quonset across the way, and Rex Strait built that up. That was a big deal for him. I mean, I was so impressed with that.
Was there ever a lot of competition between the Kinspotters and the Stinson trucking line?
Only as regards Earl Stinson, my mother's brother. He was a little bit there was some family problems over that.
I just wondered.
Sure, but it wasn't a very big issue because he was so immensely lazy that he plucked off, he cherry-picked from my grandfather Stinson's hauling. My grandfather Stinson hauled cattle, grain, gasoline, and then fertilizer. And fertilizer paid the best, and there was much, much more money in hauling fertilizer. So when Earl started trucking, he convinced Grandma and Grandpa, and that would have been my grandmother who spoke there, to give that to Earl. And Earl then began the trucking. And he only hauled, I think, one grain trailer and two or three fertilizer trailers, and that's what Earl did.
Were there other people in the trucking business at this time? Or
Martin Haskell hauled milk. And I changed these all when we had that filling station out here that's now Romano's. Because he had a pit there that you go down in and change it all. And when I had to work there, I'd got Saturday mornings, Dad would send me out to change the oil in Martin Hassel's truck and two or three other people that would wait for the weekend to do that, because I was good at that.
Did the other little towns have trucking places, or were you sort of it for the area?
Oh, no,
you were.
Well, I can't speak too well about other places, but I'm certain, beyond a reasonable doubt, that almost all little communities had their truck or two, because there were farmers needing cattle hauled and grain, so there was some of that. Now, a lot of farmers had their own trailer, but it was difficult for all except the Well Hill farmer to also own a semi.
And you talked at one point of having three trucks. And
then when he got into cattle, then he started buying and selling grain, and that caused more grain trailers. And then he got his first cattle hauling permit, hauling feeder cattle for the farmers to the Dodge City, mostly to Dodge City sale barn. Mm-hmm. And then he started hauling fat cattle for Armour and Company to Kansas City, and I got to haul a lot of those old cows for butchering. So cancer-eyed and old cows, too old to be productive anymore.
How many he keeps adding trucks, or how many?
Yes, and then Dodge City became the epicenter of Dad's business. So much that he was in the car driving back and forth and gone most of the time. So there was, in my junior and senior year, especially my senior year, the threat of moving. And the issue about taking me, I think, moved Dad's move back a year, because you were not going to take me from my friends in my school.
No.
I was going to live with Grandma and Grandpa. And I meant it, too. That was the only time I ever had an enormous fight with my dad, and that's the only time I prevailed. I would never do it. And I meant it too.
So after you graduated, then he moved the business?
59. My sister, I guess, had her bout with him. She was 2 years behind me. So it would have been the year that she graduated that he moved. And then Tom moved with them, and he disliked Dodge City so much that folks sent him to Wentworth Military Academy in Missouri for a year or so, and then back to Dodge. So he had kind of a broken up high school because of the folks moving to Dodge.
And they moved to Dodge because there was just more business there.
That's where the sale barn, both North McKinley Winters and the South Sale, and then...
Was he doing mainly cattle at that time?
Or? Yes. Yes. He had like 60 or 70 cattle trailers at
the
peak of his activity. And that big growth came from hauling fat cattle for Iowa beef packers to Emporia, Dakota City, Iowa, Denison, Iowa, Dakota City, Nebraska, Denison, Iowa, some other place up there, I forget. And then a few other odd places, Kansas City to Cudahy, and what is XL in Wichita, a little bit of that. Feeder cattle was a big business. We hauled cattle from the southeast part of the United States. We even hauled a load of mules to New Orleans for Willis, Grumby, and Dodge City, and they went for export to be used down in South America for toting whatever up and down the mountains down there. And I remember that because it was my first exposure to fresh oysters. And also, and this is, I think, interesting, when we stopped, and I never saw segregation or heard of it in my life until that trip, and it was when I was a senior in high school. And another guy and I went, because it was two drivers, and went down to haul this load of mules down to New Orleans for Willis Grumby. And the restaurants we would stop at, I caught a glimpse of, and then started watching for the Negro folks eating in the kitchen. That was my first introduction to segregation. And, you know, you'd think you lived in a hole out here or something, because you never heard of it. At least put it this way, it had nothing to do with our lives in any way.
Did you have any black kids in your class?
Yes, the Winchesters were here, and we were essentially colorblind. I mean, nobody ever here that I ever recall ever caused anything to happen by virtue of one's color differences. I had Frank Molina, a Mexican, as a classmate and a very good friend. You have to be taught to be prejudiced, which I know is the case, because to me it's unthinkable that anyone would be. We don't choose our parents, and how anybody could take it that somehow some higher being made them better than others has got to be the epicenter and the height of ignorance. It's just nonsensical.
When you were playing sports, did you play with...
Well, sure. I mean, there was only one family in town that was a Negro family.
Well, and the other team.
Oh, yeah, but you didn't... It's impossible for people today to think like that. But can you imagine seeing a rabbit on the road and remembering it like something strange happened? That's the way you felt about seeing a colored person. So what? Had nothing to do with anything. It's just, you have to be taught to be prejudiced and have parents who are in order to be thinking like that. You don't. And if you start thinking, how the hell can you be? Excuse my language. Who picks their parents? That, to me, is the most...
Did you ever sit in the balcony of the Palace Theater? Because that was for the Hispanics and the Negroes.
Not Frank Molina. I attended the theater with him all the time. Saturday afternoon.
And he sat down below?
Absolutely.
I know Galen graduated in 59 with Pat. And he went upstairs to set with the Rincon
Boys.
Well,
that must have... It absolutely did not happen with me, because Frank was my friend. Frank Molina. My classmate. My class.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely did not happen.
But it happened to others.
Not to my knowledge. I wasn't asleep either.
No, I know you weren't.
Well, at one time it was segregated that way, and you're in the period now where I think it's changing, but it actually was, I think.
At that time?
I don't know. You may be...
Well,
coming
I know
out
it
of
was
that.
In
after
Mississippi
World,
and so on when
you know,
I was
after
here.
World War II, things started, you know, people changed, and a lot of their thinking. And here, I think we have found that your people did accept, you know, the Winchesters and Gaines and... In all those
Games, I remember that.
Yeah.
Well, my father had one or two Negro truck drivers.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Where they came from, I don't recall. I think they were strangers, but in my home, and my grandfather and grandmother, and my peers, I never ever encountered that.
Mm-hmm.
I swear.
Mm-hmm.
It's just as hard to believe, probably, as it is that I have never been exposed, been offered, or accepted. I can't accept something now, but I've never offered or been exposed to marijuana. I've never, ever had it because I've never wanted it, but nobody ever offered it. Never had a friend in school, in college, that used it. So, you know, did I live in a hole? I guess I did in some ways, but no, it was not anything, it had nothing to do with me. But the thing about the Negroes eating in the kitchens, going back to that story, was shocking. And that's when I was a senior. And I thought it was horrible. Mm-hmm. I was ashamed of being there eating elsewhere. I can't imagine. I mean, I'm not saying I'm virtuous. I'm just saying that you can't think that way unless you're a goddamn idiot.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Excuse my.
We agree.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Matter of fact, I had a girlfriend in college who was black as the ace of spades. A girlfriend. And I remember some of the people, but I was big and brawny and nobody messed with me. And I was a good fighter and I swear I It had to be going on when I wasn't looking. Nobody messed
with it. Well, and I don't think it... I think Kinsley was much better than other places. So I just heard a story last night, and Rosetta knows it too, when Kenny Gaines, who would be a few years after you,
mm-hmm.
was playing
basketball. My brother's class, I think.
He was playing basketball in St. John, I believe it was, and they went in to eat at a restaurant, and they wouldn't serve him. And the whole team walked out.
Yeah, I was just going to say
that. And that's what more the attitude that was in Kinsley, you know. That,
yeah.
No,
it just wasn't a part of my life, and I'm glad of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I don't know why, but I wasn't.
Go back to your now. You were at KU, and we got you to Indiana, did we? Did we get you
mm-hmm.
to Indiana?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then you, let's see, at this time were you married?
I got married after my sophomore year in college. Yes. Okay.
And how did you meet your first wife?
She was a classmate of mine. Connor was a classmate of mine. There you go.
And so you were...
Well, I didn't ever date her in high school, but came back in the summer, and she just happened to be around one night. You know, we were at the pool all playing pool, as a matter of fact, and she and some other girls were driving out back, as they always did, you know, hey, what are you doing in there? Which was the girl's way of saying, let's get together, you know, and they would never say that, but... You know, they don't stop by just for cookies and milk. They're looking for the guys, too.
So, you met her that summer and married her that summer, or?
No, she was a classmate of mine all okay. through school.
Well, that's so what I meant. I mean, you met up that summer. When did...
Started dating her after my freshman year in college.
Mm-hmm. And got married that next year.
Yeah, a year later.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so then you were a married student going to school.
Mm-hmm. I can tell you that there was definitely religious problems at that time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know if you ought to share this or not, but being a non-Catholic, marrying a Catholic was a big deal. I had to go visit with the priest, and I refused to allow anybody to tell me that what my children would do in terms of religion. I told them it was nobody's business.
And she was okay with it?
Yes, because we married outside the church. And because of that, we were absolutely persona non grata in her home for a couple of years. It wasn't until we started having children that I guess they felt guilty enough about never being able to tell their friends that they had grandkids they didn't know. That, and that was the sole reason.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How did your family feel about you marrying a Catholic?
Well, I would guess that they weren't exactly elated.
What church did they go to church? Or
we did, the First Christian Church. Okay. I got attendance pins because my grandmother was a big deal. When later the church burned down, she was a big contributor to what was rebuilt. She was very, very religious. I mean, she talked my grandfather into getting baptized. I remember that. And he would never go to church. He would stand outside smoking a cigar until everybody got done.
I remember your grandmother. She was always she was in the choir with her hat and her gloves on. For sure.
She used a concoction of she had the greatest hand lotion on earth. That's softest skin, softest hands. And she had half vinegar, half water in one of those little deals. And every time she finished with the dishes, this business right there, and then wash it off a little while, and then wash it off.
Vinegar and water?
Half vinegar, half water. Now, Linda, I have to tell you this. My wife, and this is kind of off the beaten path,
that's
but I'm
okay.
a blabberpuss, but she was seeing a dermatologist in Denver here just 2 years ago for a number of different reasons, having to do with her face and the problems that she had. But anyhow, I got to be kind of buddy-buddy with that female dermatologist, and I told her that she was talking to my wife about her hands and stuff. I said, well, do a lot like my grandma did. And I told her, you know. And she said, vinegar is an exfoliant. If you use it in mild mm-hmm. quantities, it will get rid of old skin much before it will begin to flake, dry and flake. And she said, that is a very good thing to do. As a matter of fact, she said, Dennis, and I had a big old brown spot up here, a guy called Old Age Spot. Mm-hmm. She says, if you want, how do you get those removed? And I said, I go to a dermatologist, he sprays it with that freeze stuff. She said, you want to save some money, just get some vinegar and rub that every day a couple times with it, and in a month or so it won't be there. She said, it's an exfoliant. Never heard that word before.
Yeah, it would be an acid, so what you're probably, you know, burning it off a little bit.
Yeah, anyhow.
That's interesting.
And we always added vinegar to spinach and beans and ham, and I mean, then you go to most places, people are like, whoa, you asked for vinegar, what are you, nuts?
That's probably a German thing. I grew up in a German community.
Probably,
and,
I guess.
And we did that too. Okay, so you're in at KU, and you, I forgot in the name.
Saw the game, and disliked the game, I'm sorry. Went to the...
You went to Indiana.
Yes, transferred there.
You were in your senior year then?
I had to do one a summer catch-up, so I had to go to summer school to catch up a few of the things that they required that KU didn't. And I wanted to major in the School of Business in economics and transportation.
Now, when you major in transportation, what are you looking forward to as a job?
I thought my father and my grandfather had been in the trucking business, and my liking it so well that would be interesting and nice. I didn't want to abandon all my interest in economics, which I loved, and so I did the dual. I had a dual major.
Would you work like then for a state in their highway department?
You could look on the board during the business school for companies that were advertising.
Private companies.
Yeah, like Esso International and Mobile Oil and Ford International and so on. The big companies that were known in the university to pay the highest starting salaries. And I was interested in that. I didn't want to come back after I tried 1 year with my dad after I graduated from high school, and he and I, neither one, were ready to work with each other. So I went back and got my master's. And I worked as a janitor in school and got a graduate assistantship to work for one of the professors in his research with private businesses, like the canalization of the Tennessee Tom Bigby River, for one, and airline mergers. I was the guy behind the scenes that did all the research. And this is why I moved from Kansas to Indiana, because I was promised that extra job. And then I also was a janitor. So I got lots of favors for jobs, which allowed me to go there.
And you had children by this time.
Yeah,
so you had
two.
A family to take care of.
Yeah.
And then earlier you were talking about your brush with maybe a Fulbright, was it?
Yeah, that missed it by. I was 1 year late because the requirement of teaching for a year before you could be awarded a Fulbright was enacted exactly at the moment that I didn't need it. Had I applied 12 months previous, I would have had it, because that particular position at the University of Melbourne had not been awarded for 2 years. And that Waters said, hey, you know, he was on the Fulbright committee, I know how you can go to Australia paid, you know, for a year. Man, you think that didn't light my interest up. But that came in from the side, and I was tired of being broke, and I couldn't stand it. So it was all just a nice dream.
But you didn't come back at that time. You went to New Jersey.
I went to work for... I got a job with Esso International.
What year was that?
The highest paid job offered, because I graduated with honors. And I love school. And, you know, if you love something, you do well. I did. I blew them away. I got in all the honors classes when I was working on my master's. And I still had the jobs, because I had to have. But,
what year did you go to New Jersey then?
The year Kennedy was assassinated. That was my first year there.
63.
Yeah. Yep. I went to work for Esso International, and it was there.
What did you do for them?
I worked in the transportation department.
Was that
economics?
Planning?
At the time, we had our job was optimizing the two things: the managing the relationship between owned tonnage or ships, oil ships, and leased tonnage or oil ships. They had a magic formula that somebody there had said, we're not going to own as a corporation more than 50% of our annual shipping needs. It just came, you know, like all kinds of rules do, who knows where. And that was being challenged, mostly at my behest, because I, after I became familiar with that, what their business was like and so on, and I progressed through the channels well because I loved the job. And then I was there 7 months, and I got my first group of men to work for me. I had 25 economists that come working for me, and it was difficult because I was so young. You know, usually you had to be grad to Temples, and, but it was a good job in the sense that you didn't have to be grad to Temples in order to succeed. They recognized hard workers and people that did well. But anyhow, I got that changed with a whole series of meetings that also turned out to be my undoing, because some of the folks there, and then and also the alteration of existing T2 ships by making them longer and deeper, all more versus buying new, I sent out a memo saying, you know, it'd be better to sink the old ones at the high seas and buy or lease for a year and then buy, then to do that. And I made a big case of it. I worked on that on weekends on my own time. And I had the facts with me because I gathered it up from people there. But I stepped on too many toes. And I knew that was going to happen, but didn't realize that the facts would, because all my life, if you were right, you still passed through well. I had my first shot at politics, corporate politics. And man, they moved me to the Marine Sales Department. Did me a favor, because it was within a month of that I quit. And another fellow and I borrowed some money from a fellow that wanted to sell his real estate business. And we started... Not started the apartment broker, but started renting apartments, and then I expanded that with my partner to selling of real estate.
And this was still in New Jersey?
In New York.
In New York.
So New Jersey was our bedroom, and New York was the office. And then, because he lived in New York and I lived in New Jersey, then I got my realtor license in New Jersey and started selling land. I loved that, but I didn't like the anonymity of the East. I didn't like my children being raised there, because I thought children's behavior toward their parents was unacceptably rude, but nevertheless, the way they did it, parents tolerated way beyond what I could stand the differences that children had with the way they were raised. And you know, it'd be like trying to nail jelly to the wall. You're not going to change the way your kids are raised when all their peers are sassing their parents and using words that I would have been nailed to the wall over. But they're very, very, very different, and I couldn't take it.
So when did you?
So we
come
moved
back
here in 1972.
72.
And with my father, and it was after he had had his heart attack, also worked out well, and he was ready to get out, and so that's when I started in with the truck line, and my brother a year later came also and joined. He'd come from the FAA, where he was flying jets for them and teaching people to do that, and then we bought the business, and that brings us to that point.
And you've had the business ever since.
But I dearly love Kansas. And I know it has a lot to do with how you're raised, but I used to defend Kansas because people would say from back east, what part of the South are you from? Because you have a little bit of a drawl, you know? And you say, Kansas? I went through Kansas once. I didn't think I was ever going to get through that state. All I saw was flat land. Wheat. What do you folks do there? You know, you're immediately on the defensive. Mm-hmm. And I got so tired of that, I finally would say, you know, Kansas is really not a good place to live. I'd recommend that you not come there or visit, because the virtue of Kansas is the absence of people. Mm-hmm. And that just leaves, because they get so tired of being on the defensive about, I mean, there I did not dare go into the issue about they are the most provincial of all. They travel less. They go to Europe, but they don't go anywhere else. Europe and Florida, back there. And for them, a trip to the around the east to the historic places in the East Coast, oh, it'd take 2 or 3 weeks. For me, drive there the next, you know, be there the next day. Go all over Connecticut, New York State, Pennsylvania. I traveled all over the East Coast back there and loved it. And I would go to the New York City museums, which were fabulous, on the weekends when New York City's trying to get out of town, and then I'd be coming back when they're trying to get back in. So I never had a traffic issue. I was going against the grain because I lived 50 miles from where I worked, which was unheard of then. Who would do that? But I lived on a farm, rented a place, and then I bought a house next to the farm.
You didn't live in the city then?
No. In fact, I got a job out there with a guy who had a dairy herd. I loved it.
How many kids were in your high school graduating class?
43 or 4.
How many of them either stayed here or came back to live here like you did? How was that class?
No. Well, to answer the first part of your question, stayed would be the farmer kids, didn't go to school. I don't know, I would guess dozen. I'd have to go through them name by name and tell you, but I could. But Jay Shaler was one. He stayed. But most of the boys made a stab at college someplace.
Did they? And did your classmates serve in the Korean War? Or
no, that was...
Were you in, sort of in between?
Korea was what, 50 or 51, wasn't it? Well, we graduated in 57, so see, Korea was before us.
You're a little
young,
a little bit before Vietnam then?
Well, Vietnam was, I'm guessing, around 30. I was around 30 when the guy I had the real estate business was fighting hard to avoid being drafted for Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So it would have been around age 30 or so, the Vietnam.
So you were sort of in between your age.
Right. And I didn't have to worry about Vietnam because I had children, mm-hmm. so I was not going to be drafted. And I sure didn't want to be over there in the jungle. And those folks were the ones, they got the biggest shaft of the century. They gave their lives and fought through that mess over there and come back to the idiots that were demonstrating against them and taking out their dislike on being in a war on the individuals who were there to defend us and represent us. I thought that was horrible.
And when you came back, you lived in Kinsley? When you came back
to Dodge City.
You went to Dodge City.
You're a good person
to ask, though, because you left and then came back in the early 70s. What changes did you see from when you were growing up here and coming back
in Kinsley? Well, there are a lot more closed doors uptown on Main Street, for one. Most of the kids that were here because they're parents had, or they had married farming interests, were still here. But those of us who didn't have that were largely elsewhere, because there weren't any jobs to be had outside of agriculture here that I can think of at all. Maybe John Wire could have said worked in the bank. I think he was the only exception, you know, that kind of thing. But there were a lot of closed doors, and it's understandable there weren't any job opportunities. That's the first thing that kept you away. If you lived there, you had to drive to your work in Dodge or Larned or wherever, and that's still the same today.
Well, even the farming took less people because of the
correct, because of this, right. Mm-hmm. Yep, bigger tractors, less manpower required, and irrigation opportunities abounded in Dodge and feed yards. Kinsley became a bedroom community for the, except for, you know, the farmers. It's no change from today. Kinsley is a bedroom community, except for farmers, farmer-related people, and the attorneys and teachers. You know, the infrastructure
the
people
county,
are here, but
county school and the
economic
hospital.
Activity is largely absent, except for the ag thing. And that's it. There's no factors. And I remember in high school the argument that my father, who was mayor one year or one term here, about a vote taken, and I think this is correct, Montgomery Ward's wanted to build a warehouse here. Is that not right?
I think so.
Yeah, and there was a great deal of trouble here among adults, I recall, in arguing about the virtues or not of it coming. And, you know, very few people here wanted to change things. And I think there was a general resistance to change that helped contribute to the economic apathy that predominated here. My uncle Daniel would have been a poster child for that kind of thought, because he, for instance, when we were here, this is before I came, but when this community was engaged in this decision about whether or not we should have more flood control up through here, he was the one who was vehemently opposed to it. And yet his farm was, his 100 acres there that I now have, has a major waterway through it, which to this day, when it rains too much, still flows. And, you know, it has to do with your, whether you want to live in the past or the future. That's all it's about. And you have to be more willing to answer the challenges of tomorrow than yesterday in order to stand for changes. And changes always bring about better things, usually. Not always, but usually.
But then, now, eventually in here, and I don't know, we didn't ask that, you were divorced and remarried and
came back here and got a divorce in 1978. And that was 6 years after I moved back from the East. And married, and 15 months later or 16 months later, and stayed in Dodge and lived there until we moved to Cimarron. And we made that move because of the inundation of Dodge City schools with the Latins, and that was an issue only because of the willingness and the readiness and the cultural propensity to fight physically in settling children's arguments. And what really happened, aside from that dislike of all the threats that turned into physical fisticuffs, which we tolerated, was when we were eating at a Chinese restaurant and our one daughter stayed home, Andrea, to us. Study for some big test or something. And a car full of six Latin Americans come in there, and they were all high school or college people. Knocked on the front door, she went outside, they drug her, beat the heck out of her, sent her to the hospital. That's where we heard, got the phone call. It changed our lives, especially my life. I'm not saying I wasn't affected because of that, but it was just their idea of a fun day. And, We lived in a nice house on the edge of town, which I had purchased from my real estate profits back east. And I built it because, for me, the real estate prices were nothing compared to what I had been used to. So I built a beautiful ranch on Avenue P that has all those big double rows of Austrian pines in it on the northeast side of Dodge. That I planted those from this height and measured and did all the planting, did that was mine. And that's the house they drug her out of and just beat the part. And I mean, did a hell of a job on her. And it never was the same in our household after that, because there had, it wasn't just that that happened, it was the kids were involved in a lot of slappings, you know, getting the heck slapped out of them with girls, mostly girls, fighting girls. They really engage in the fisticuffs much more readily than the whites. It's a cultural thing with them. But it was something that so dominated the classes that it became, you know, got on point on them and became fearful and defensive. And then that happened. So we moved something. In fact, I bought a little house in Cimarron, because you could not go send your kids to school unless you lived there. So I bought a little house there and rented it out in order to meet that requirement. And then we bought 1,000 acres there and built that house. And then about 7 years later, I tangled with the Sunflower Bank, who failed to honor a lien release on some cattle and trucks that I had, because I had, and I even had covered my tracks with the president of the Bank of the Southwest in Dodge, Marlon Radetzky, and I've got it to this day, it's came on my computer. But I made a deal with him, and I made the move for interest rate reduction to, if I would pay off a loan, a $277,000 loan, that they would release and my assets were enumerated. And tooled along and got a loan and part of that here at the Kinsley Bank, and got the call, hey, we need a release on the collateral on these trucks and trailers. And so I just assumed it was a mistake. Long story short, the people at Salina that owned the bank, their headquarters, said, we're not honoring our man's agreement because he wasn't authorized above $100,000. Well, you don't have a sign there on the desk that says that. And I thought, you know, that I didn't care, because I was angry, but never had a bill problem in my life, made lots of money relative to a lot of people, and doing very well at the time. Had a couple thousand head of cattle on feed, really blowing and going, and loved it all. Had the trucking business, and had made a lot of money. But anyhow, I had a big IRA, and my wife had one. And I had that letter. And I went, finally, after I got it through my thick head that they meant business, I went to an attorney and started to sue them. Same time they filed on me, because I had my mortgage at my home and on the land. So I quit paying the mortgage. I thought, I'm going to really make some money here. I'm going to sue these folks. I know I'll prevail in a bank, because banks are sympathetic to individuals who get screwed. And I was, happened to be on their loan committee and on the board of directors at the bank for 7 years. So I really felt I knew my ins and outs and had my ducks covered. But anyhow, I had to pay for the defense to not only myself, the legal defense, but the truck line, because my brother was partnering. He wasn't about to pay, and shouldn't have, because they started threatening the assets of the truck line, because I refused to pay. I said, you return my lien, and they wouldn't do it. So I cashed in my IRAs and I started paying all the legal fees. And $200,000+ later, I'm still involved in the middle of a lawsuit. It's going nowhere. My attorney assured me that they could appeal it 4 or 5 times, take years. And he said, look, Dennis, he said, you're the most stubborn person I've ever dealt with. You just sure think because you think you got a little money that you're going to prevail on that letter. He said, you have to have one thing before you do. You have to have money to pay for your legal defense to make it all the way, because the bank got a hell of a lot more money than you do. And they're going to appeal this all the way. Well, it took a month or two to come to grips with it, but I filed bankruptcy because I was not about to do what was wrong and not agree to. And then, of course, that ended my part of the lawsuit, but the other bank, which was also involved in it, the farm credit in Dodge City, had some other land I had and had the cattle, some cattle, joined with me in the lawsuit against the Sunflower. Well, they finally, 2 years later, prevailed in court and won bukus of money. But you know, it was 2 years too late for me. If I'd have had some rich daddy that had a lot of legal money, I could have probably retired, because in the end, they screwed me. I had the letter, and I was just I just never bumped into anybody that could chew me up and spit me out like that. And that's what they did. But you know what? You run into problems in your life, and some of them are your own making and some aren't, but still you're the guy that, and my stubbornness and my unwillingness to do what was wrong because I thought right would always prevail. That left one thing out, and that is you got to have money to make right prevail.
So is that when you came back to Kinsley itself?
Yep, come back here. And, you know, the issue about what people think, I never really worried too much about that. So that's not been an issue. As long as I'm happy with myself and that I've got a family and the other folks, I mean, they can think of me what they want. I don't really care about that. I don't. Because I've never done anything worse than just a speeding ticket in my life.
And you still have the trucking.
Yeah,
business.
And I bought, and I'm still making bankruptcy payments. I took Chapter 13 instead of 7 because I had oil wells at the time. And I made in court, the judge finally agreed to, because I said I'd sold more oil. I have like 11 oil wells in Utica, Kansas. And this last year, I got $180,000 from those 11 oil wells. Okay. Anyhow, I told him, the judge says, I have sold more oil at less than $11 a barrel than above, because the bank, you know, said they're going to make a lot more. And I said, I've got years of experience, and this is what it's been. And you cannot bet on the come like that unless I'm reimbursed for it. And so I was able to, that was one good move, because I kept the truck line and I kept the oil wells. Financially, to be honest with you, it's been almost better. I mean, I lost a lot of cattle, lost a lot of money. And my wife, she's never liked the, she's always worried, you know, what's going on. Honey, if you haven't stolen anything, and if you haven't hurt anybody, and you've been answered to the Lord, you'll be all right. So, and I love Kinsley.
Yeah.
And there hasn't been anybody ever make me feel badly about it. I don't think anybody ever will.
That's good. Did you have other questions you were thinking about the trucking or the where things were? She's always the one trying to figure out exactly where things
are. I kind of know. You know, I knew where your trucking line, where that was, and you know, I know where Oscar Stinson lived. And of that area, and I know where Daniel lived, you know, had his farm out there by the settlement.
Right.
So I kind of know that, but right now.
Any voids? Informational voids that you think need to be filled? I mean, is there any area of it that I've not...
Probably
filled?
After you leave.
After you leave. But you've done, you know,
you've done
covered
a good
it
job,
very
yeah.
well. And a lot I didn't know. I mean, after you graduated, I didn't know what all you did, you know, anything like that.
And I think it's interesting, like I said, that you did come back and you can see the differences. I think on these concluding thoughts we had, you pretty well covered it one place or another. You know, I think you told us how Edwards County affected your life and living in this type of an environment, mm-hmm. and we talked a little bit about the decreased population. The last question we haven't talked about, what do you see for the future of Edwards County with our, you know, I think our population maybe is sort of
well,
leveled off,
the answer to that, you would have to qualify by saying it's based on the following presumptions, or assumptions, which are agriculture is doing very well now, and I think that it has a bright future relative to any other segment of our economy, like manufacturing. I can't imagine agriculture having seen its worst days.
Do you see the farms staying family farms or going to the big corporate?
Well, there would have to be changes in tax laws to change much of that, because who in their right mind would want to leave farming? For what? It'd have to be a rare opportunity in order to do that, because you wouldn't even, you know, now it's so different now than it was when I was growing up. They had to worry about making ends meet with the wheat prices the way they are. I used to talk about not even needing cargo insurance to haul wheat because a load of dirt was more valuable than a load of wheat. You know, and that's not the case anymore. And I think the economic reality of the situation is that we're in a good place at a good time. And I know for sure that we're less affected in general here than all the other areas of most all the other areas. I know it's factual too, because I was listening one day on, I think it was Fox News, but this is like in the last 6 months that they were talking about the county in the United States that had the highest unemployment. It was in Ohio. And it was, I don't know, 18-20%, something like that. But at the, kind of an addendum at the end of the presentation, it said, and by the way, the county in the United States that has the least unemployment, guess where that's at? And I was thinking, well, it can't miss us too far. And it was Ford County, Kansas. And guess where the next was? It includes Garden Fennie County, and then the next one was the county that liberals in. Mm-hmm. And then when the governor, whoever, helped inaugurate the casino, some mention was made in that speech. I wasn't there, but heard about it, to the fact that this was nice. It was nice to be in an area that was progressive and economically thriving. We have as much difficulty getting drivers today as we ever have, and mechanics, and people in the office. It's, for us, you think we're living in a little mecca, because what you read in the paper sure as heck doesn't have anything to do with us. Our business could not be busier. People eat meat still. It's just the price of the meat. And this leads to the economics of not just farming and crops, but to beef. Beef will always be eaten. It's just the price that you pay for it, because you're not going to kill cows. You will over time reduce cow herds and so forth, but we're the epicenter of the production of the fat cattle, and that isn't going to change, and here's why. Because the killing plants are located near where the feed yards are, and they're there because of the weather and the cheap grain. And the weather isn't going to change here relative to anyplace else. And the grain isn't going to quit growing here unless it does everywhere. So you have those two factors that are going to make sure that that stays the same. And even when killing plants reduce their kill because of the battles that the buyers and the sellers of meat have 4 or 5 times a year, they shut down plants in Nebraska and Iowa and Texas and Arkansas and Colorado. We're the last to be affected. Cargill, for instance, with all their plants, when we have reductions in kill, the last hours they cut down are Dodge City because the cattle are cheaper here, because they have less freight against them. And you haul 9 pounds of grain into an animal for every 1 pound of beef you raise. So you're sure as heck not going to move the cattle feeding to places away that require the hauling of grain. They're there here for weather and grain prices. Now, you could ask the question, why is it that they're not in Iowa and Illinois where the corn is? Weather. Cattle do poorly in cold, wet weather. They don't gain well. They don't lay down and slop. You know, they stand and stress instead of resting while here. So, to further answer your question, in addition to crops, meat is going to, and the activity that surrounds the production of fat beef isn't going to go anyplace. It's going to stay. So I think the economic activity here bodes well for this area. I think for this community that we will be fortunate if we gather together some young people who start bringing economic activity here. Now, what would that be? It'd be supporting businesses and I've thought, for instance, in my little world, of bringing reefer refrigeration center here because you can't hardly find a place to live in that city. And the rent is through the ceiling. And it's cheaper to buy gasoline than it is. And we have here, Kinsley, Lewis, Jetmore, Mineola. We have over 2/3 of our employees living outside of Dodge City and driving. Well, they don't need to drive daily. It's not like an office job. They are out 3 to 4 times a week. So a lot of the trucking repairs that are taking place there could take place here. And, you know, that kind of thing for other businesses will only move out from Dodge because Dodge is growing like crazy. And people don't like to have their children queued up with boxing gloves every day like they have to have over there. And I'm not the only one that's moved from Dodge.
No.
And I think, therefore, that Kinsley, they might go less in population, but I can't imagine us doing worse, very much worse. It's my opinion. Because the rising tide raises all boats. And so those are two areas of economic activity that are going to help keep us around this. I think we reached close to the low economically in this community. I think if we get people to clean this community up, make it more attractive, get rid of the junk you see around this place, which are only cancers that affect dying communities. If you get rid of the symptoms, you'll help alleviate the problem. That would be the first thing if I led this community that I would do. There would be big changes in that area. Get rid of the cancer. Who wants to live in a place, a yard or a home or a town that has a bunch of junk around? I mean, who's attracted to that? So that's, Greensburg was, in my opinion, the epicenter of the dumpy surroundings. So the tornado couldn't affect a better location. But the community around here, I think, would be well advised to get rid of the signs of decay and economic malaise. I just can't believe that and I blame myself in part because I've been here long enough to get involved. I think people like who feel like I do need to quit thinking about it and start talking about it and address these issues. And I have spent some time talking to, his father drove from the, worked for the ADM, what's his name? Wears glasses. Anyhow, he's a commissioner, I believe, or...
City commissioner?
Kraft.
Okay.
Kraft. He's big on this, and he's doing some things about it, and I've talked to him sometimes, but I think more need to be involved, and people like me need to quit talking about this.
Okay, it might be a good place to stop unless you have something else you want to add.
Not now. But I know,
you got me kind of revved up. I talked you right into the ground here.
That's, well, you've done a wonderful job.
Yeah.